Survival in a refugee camp can take on many forms and behaviors, from playing soccer to having a child to trying to walk out. In part five of our series, 6 Degrees of Separation, WAER's Anjali Alves reports on how people made do in the refugee camps in Greece. Some clung to activities from home in Syria. Some formed a government of sorts or befriended their overseers. Some thought of brighter futures. To those assisting the refugees, survival took on surprising forms.
The go-home blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers, sucking our country dry, niggers with their hands out, they smell strange, savage, messed up their own country and now they want to mess ours up. How do the words, the dirty looks roll off your backs? Maybe it's because the blow is softer than a limb torn off, or the words more tender than 14 men between your legs, or the insults easier to swallow than rubble, than bone, than your child's body in pieces. I want to go home. But home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of a gun, and no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home told you to quicken your legs, leave your clothes behind, crawl through the desert, wade through the oceans, drown, save, be hungry, beg, forget pride. Your survival is more important. Survival was the goal in the camps. It was something that Dr. Sam Song saw a lot of in her time as an OBGYN with the Syrian American Medical Society on trips to both Jordan and Greece. She speaks about two women she met who opened her eyes for very different reasons.
I have a really good story. It actually was at this government camp. So a patient came in for something like vaginitis. And I had made it a point to bring condoms, you know. So after we took care of the vaginitis issue, I said to her, I said, do you need birth control? And she's like, birth control. And she's like, what's that? I said, you know, so that you don't get pregnant. And she looked at me and she said, you have that? I said, yeah, I have that. I can help you. You know, I can give you 3 months and then you can come back if you're still here. And she told my interpreter this. She says to my interpreter, it was like the skies opened up and the heaven came to her because I offered her contraception. But she was so happy that she said, I've never been offered contraception, and yes, I want to take contraception. Actually, it did make our day.
Other women's stories were slightly different.
I had this one conversation with a young lady, you know, who was newly married. It seemed like they married young there, and I said, well, why would you want to get pregnant in this situation? And her answer to me, she kind of put me in my place in this regard. She said, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I could be here for years. And if I don't get pregnant, you know, my husband will be very disappointed in me. And we have to still continue our family. Our grandparents have died. My uncle was killed. She had many people in her family who had died. She said, we still have to continue to live, even in this situation.
Whatever the reason, it was clear that people in the camps were trying to do more than just survive. They wanted to live. There were soccer matches played. People would collect around the main courtyard and watch the young men play. They'd pick sides and root cheerfully for their team. Lara Zakaria worked as a pharmacist in the camps in Jordan, which were much larger and more established than the ones in Greece. But she noticed in Jordan as well, the same thing. People always found a way to survive.
And it was definitely, there was a lot more life and joy than I expected to see, which was a huge relief. And it was actually very heartening to see how resilient the people were. And how resilient the kids were, and how happy they were to see us. And, you know, there was a little strip that they set up shop. So they have a bike shop and, you know, a little clothing store and even like a lingerie store. There was life. And just to show kind of how Syrian sense of humor is, they called that strip the Champs-Élysées. And they were very proud of that name, of the ironic name that they had chosen.
The camps in Greece are becoming more established as the months go by and people try to make the best of things. In one camp, the refugees set up a panel of elders to represent them and communicate their needs to humanitarian aid groups. The first thing they asked for? A school for the children.
Alpha.
Alpha.
Beta.
Beta.
Gamma.
Gamma.
Zeta.
Zeta.
Working as field coordinator, Maddie tried her best to facilitate the community relations that were slowly forming at some camps.
Someone brought their espresso machine from Idemini. People were bringing their hot plates. So there was like a cooking area. There was a community cooking area in the front near the outlets. And then in back there had cooking fires and all the women could do their thing together and spend time together. And there was a class. Well, it wasn't really a classroom. It was just like a space on the back of the loading docks that had some mats. And all the kids could go back and do classes together, that kind of thing. So I think just setting up some sort of routine is huge for people. It's like, okay, well, we're going to sleep in because it's really hot, and then get up and make our coffee and then go sit with the barber and chat about life. And then once it's cooler, then we can pull out the speakers and dance, and all the kids are going to run around and play football and that kind of thing. The first week or so of moving in and settling in is kind of tricky. Everyone's just really frazzled and trying to just get situated generally and get used to the flow of things. But once they established that rhythm and schedule, it was really great to see everybody sort of come together again, and everyone started cooking together again and playing soccer together again, and somebody brought speakers, and so all the men were doing dabka together, and that was really great.
Everyone seems to appreciate the volunteers and what the Greek government and military have provided, but the sadness and anger after being in these camps for 6 months is apparent.
We're coming from the strike country. You destroyed your country, now you're coming to destroy our country. Then for sure, that's not our goal. We are here because of you. You destroyed our country, not we. You sent the guns for that. You just shut your mouth up when your government was sending guns for that. Why you didn't speak to them? This is not our fault. That's your fault. You just burned the fire, and the fire started there, and it's continued to be here. And it will continue to be in your mouth, the same mouth speaking about that. Repeating that on us, refugee, destroying your country, coming to destroy our country. Yeah, we are really like forgive, yeah. But sometimes you have limited energy to forgive. If you don't want to help us, don't help us. One day you will be in the same. We will not give you our hand. You will be alone. After 6 years of war, we are losing in every year, in every day, or in every hours, a lot of people there. No one care. No one care.
I've been adapting a lot, trying to avoid anger. And now it's very easy for me to be sitting on my couch here in Ireland and telling other Latvians, don't be angry, you know, and don't be frustrated and keep hope and et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it's very difficult.
This is Dr. Wael Barrow. He's a physician from Ireland, born and raised in Lebanon, and capable of bringing both Eastern and Western perspectives into his thoughts and actions. He's great friends with many in the camps, and it's clear that he cares deeply for Abdulaziz.
Be hundreds of papers there. So eventually, Abdulaziz is going to move somewhere. I have no doubt. His family will get relocated somewhere. The question is when. And with Abdulaziz, it's the time factor that I feel the burden. So I could imagine how difficult for him. Because every day passes, he's losing it a bit more of his ambition and his positivity.
Living in the camps is difficult psychologically, and Abdulaziz is not the only young person being negatively impacted by life in the camps.
My name is Simav Hussein.
And you're 15?
Yes.
Simav is a Kurdish girl who lived in Aleppo for most of her life. She lives in the camps with three younger siblings and her mother, who's an artist and fashion designer.
I was born in Syria, in Afrin. After it, we moved. To Aleppo, and I was there like 11 years. I went to school, everything. And when it's war, we came back to our town, and it wasn't safe. It's like Aleppo.
When you left, was that when a lot of people were leaving? Or?
Yes. There are lots of people leaving from Syria.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them died in Syria, like my cousin. This is our life in Syria.
Simav's father took €8,000 and traveled from Turkey to Italy. When the war got especially bad, her mother took her and her three siblings to Turkey. From there, they traveled by sea to Greece. It took them four tries because they kept getting caught by the Turkish military. Finally, they made it to Greece.
I don't know, it's very difficult. And then we came to Greece, and from Greece to Idomeni. In Idomeni was like 3 months in Idomeni. And then we came here, and we are here 2 months, and we tried two times to go to Macedonia, and they catch us, and it's very difficult.
Many people have tried to walk out of northern Greece into Fyrom, which stands for the former Yugoslavic Republic of Macedonia. There's a regional debate over what constitutes Macedonia, but the point is, leaving the refugee camp once in Greece is not easy.
Some of them have the money, they're trying. Some of them don't have money like me. I'm staying here.
How much money do you need to leave?
A lot of money, a lot.
What's the next big change, you think?
Nothing. I think we're gonna stay here for years and nobody asks for us. There are people helping us, but it's not enough. We don't want to help. We want to go from here. Go out. Be free. I didn't see my dad since 1 year and 5 months. My mom, she's a fashion designer.
Has your mom talked to you about what she wants for the future?
Yes, she wants to put us in safe place. That's all she wants. And we go to school and university.
What do you want to study?
Engineer plane.
Really? That's so cool. What got you interested in that?
I don't know. Because I was dreaming if sometimes I get the plane.
Simav makes a swooping gesture with her hand. Up and out. She dreams of having a plane and flying away.
Ultimately, what they need is you putting them in your luggage or on your back and getting them where they want to go. And there are many, many people. You hold their hand, you squeeze their hand, say, I'm sorry. Yeah, deeply, on behalf of everyone, but we are trying to help you. There are people helping. We didn't forget about you. And for the time being, this is the only thing I could give you, some painkillers for your muscular pain. But it doesn't work for you, the pain that you really have, you being stuck here.
All five of the 6 degrees of separation pieces are on our website, along with pictures of Anjali's experience at waer.org. And the next and final piece of 6 degrees of separation will also be on NPR One. Thanks.